Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So with Friday's disappointing jobs report having implications for the presidential race, Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman argues in his New York Times column today that the problem is President Obama is already pursuing a Republican set of economic policies. With us to argue that Keynesian case is Paul Krugman, whose new book, And This Depression Now, has become a bestseller in Spain recently. Dr. Krugman, always good of you to come on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning.
What do you mean by the Democratic president is pursuing Republican economic policies?
Well, what I actually said was the country is. Now, I'm not sure that you want to say exactly that Obama is, since he's been under constraint. But if you look at what's actually happening, government spending, taking the broad view, although it's actually true of federal spending as well, but looking at all levels of government spending is dropping like a stone. Once you adjust for inflation and population growth, real per capita government spending has been falling at a rate that we haven't seen in 60 years. You have to go back to the demobilization after the Korean War to find anything like it. So this is anti-Keynesian policies. If you want to ask, what's happening, why is the economy failing? Well, it's not because government spending is not working. It's because we're actually slashing government while the economy is still very deeply depressed.
But if you look at the Obama 4 years overall, before this current slashing came the $800 billion stimulus program, which helped inspire the Tea Party and the backlash over rising debt on the political level.
Wow.
Here is Romney on the stump in South Carolina about this in January.
He failed to put Americans back to work. Remember, he was early in his administration. He said, look, if you'll let me borrow $787 billion, why we'll be able to keep unemployment from going above 8%. Well, it went past 8% and hasn't been back since, 3 years later.
So that's part of the Romney case. How do you see the big picture of 4 years rather than just the last two?
Over the 4 years, basically, there's been nothing exceptional. So there was a brief period of higher spending that faded out, and it wasn't much. Remember, a large part of that stimulus bill was actually tax cuts, and a large part of the rest was temporary aid to state and local governments, which was a way to try and avoid cuts in spending. And then there was a little bit of infrastructure spending, though not much, and an increase in unemployment payments, which is, what's supposed to happen when you have a deeply depressed economy. Nothing besides that. So the overall record is not at all of any kind of spending boom. And we should have had at least a moderate spending boom, because when you have a deeply depressed economy, which we still do, you want the government to be stepping in when the private sector can't. So what's happened is, effectively, Republicans have blocked Obama from doing any of the things that Democratic, or at least, what people like me say he should be doing. And then they're claiming his policies have failed, when in fact they ensured that policies like that were never even tried.
But we're still running $1 trillion-a-year deficits.
Yeah, and the people who have actual money at stake are not worried about that. The United States is able to borrow at lower rates than just about any time in its history. Now, you do want to worry about deficits in the long run. You do want to worry about the long-run solvency of the U.S. government. But trying to slash spending in the middle of a depression, which has, I have the book called End This Depression Now. Mm-hmm. In the middle of a depression, when the economy is basically on the mat, trying to slash spending doesn't even help your deficit position, because it shrinks the economy. It shrinks the economy's long-run potential. It makes the economy less likely to generate tax receipts in the future. And since the borrowing comes at such a low interest rate anyway, cutting back on borrowing really helps you not at all. On balance, penny-pinching right now is bad even on purely fiscal terms, let alone the impact, of course, on the unemployed.
But when you say those with a stake in the debt don't seem to be concerned about it, meaning China and other folks are willing to invest in
China, by the way. That's one of those big things that people say. It's not the Chinese financing us for the most part now, and the fact of the matter is we're awash in savings with no place to go. We've got corporations sitting on trillions of dollars of cash that they don't want to invest, not because they're afraid of socialism, but because they don't have customers. So there's plenty of money out there, and U.S. public debt is viewed as one of the safer things out there.
Romney would say, the Wall Street Journal editorial page would say, that a lot of the reason that businesses aren't investing is that there's all this uncertainty. The Journal, for example, made the case on Saturday after the jobs numbers came out that one of the things is the Obama approach to tax cuts, which is temporary targeted tax cuts. And they say that's wrong because people are not stupid. That was their words. That business owners know that if they're temporary, they're going to go away, and then the business owners are going to be stuck with the bill rather than across the board tax cuts.
Well, there's a in part that's a reason why people like me say that we should rely to as far as possible on spending rather than tax cuts, temporary tax cuts to boost the economy. If you think about it, is the Journal saying that every time the economy is depressed, we should cut taxes permanently? That looks like a ratchet to me. Doesn't that lead us eventually to having no taxes at all? Right? That's not a solution that makes any sense. It really doesn't. It doesn't hang together if you think about it for even a couple of seconds. And the fact of the matter is that the kinds of tax cuts that President Obama has been proposing are not, for the most part, for businesses or for rich people who will do that kind of smoothing. They are for people who are working, people who are with lower incomes, people who are, in fact, living a little bit on the edge, living paycheck to paycheck. And those people will, in fact, spend tax cuts if they're given the money.
New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, my guest on WNYC, 212-433-WNYC. If you want to join the conversation or post a comment or a question to our webpage at WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Bob in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Paul Krugman. Hi, Bob.
Oh, hello, Brian.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Krugman. Hello?
Hello.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, thank you. I will vote for President Obama because I like his health care plan, and I'm against the Republican tax policies. But I must say I don't like his economic policies regarding the budget. I do believe the national debt is what's causing the problems because it's my understanding the huge national debt causes a lack of confidence in the currency. When the value of the dollar drops, this drives up the price of everything imported. Even though price of gas has come down a little bit, we have high gasoline prices, high home heating oil prices because of the weak currency, all because of the national debt. And may I just say, I think the evidence was when President Clinton worked with the Congress, they balanced the budget, they strengthened the currency, and the price of gasoline dropped to 99 cents a gallon. I think that's the best stimulus. I think the present Obama policies of spending money, the quantitative easing, the low interest rates, is just making a bad situation worse.
Okay. So the first thing you probably want to know is that the dollar has actually been fairly strong, certainly substantially stronger now than it was for a good part of the Bush administration. And the dollar has been strengthening lately against the euro for obvious reasons. And by the way, that is a good thing for us. It's a good thing for the Europeans and a bad thing for us. Right now, a weak currency is our friend. The really important thing is how competitive are our manufactured goods? How are they going to compete on world markets? And a strong dollar makes them less competitive. A weak dollar makes them more competitive. Look at the Japanese, who are actually tearing their hair out because the yen has also been getting strong. Which, by the way, again, for people who say, "Oh, debt is a crisis," look at the fact that Japan, which has got debt of 200% of GDP. The fact that the yen is actually turning out to be too strong right now for their tastes and, in fact, for their economy. So no, that's the wrong way around. And I have a real critique of President Obama's policy, which was he went for a soft touch at the beginning, and he listened too much to the bankers. But that's all water under the bridge. Now, at this point, the question is, do you want to vote for somebody who will take everything that we're doing wrong and do it with a vengeance?
But when you talk about stakeholders in the debt, you were referring to people who are buying U.S. government debt. But there are other stakeholders, presumably our children and their children, who, if some of the economists are right, that debt over the long term, even if it's not going to crash us like Greece because we're not in similar economic conditions, it'll raise interest rates over the long run because there's a lot of money to pay back. It'll create a large percentage of the tax dollar that has to go to debt, which means probably more taxes in order to pay for other government services going down the road. Are you not very concerned about those things?
this argument drives me up the wall. Not because debt isn't a burden. It is. But you have to have, on the one hand, the extra, some sense of you know, how much does even $1 trillion of borrowing, how much is that going to be a burden on the future? It's not nothing, but it's very small. Remember, we can borrow at about a 1.5% interest rate right now. And in fact, if you protect the bonds against inflation, it's you can actually borrow for nothing right now. The U.S. government can. And then if you really care about our children, you should be worried about the fact that we've got a job market right now in which a large fraction of kids coming out of college with all that burden of a personal debt that they've run up in order to be able to afford that college are finding that they can't find jobs, or they can't find full-time jobs, or if they can find a full-time job, they're working as a barista at Starbucks instead of being able to make use of all those expensively acquired skills. And we know there's a lot of evidence that students who graduate into a poor job market never make up for that. That's casting a shadow over their entire careers. So if you care about our kids, you should be doing something about creating a job market in which college graduates can get somewhere. And instead of listening to a bunch of bankers who have these sort of who talk big about the dangers of debt, but if you actually do the arithmetic, it turns out that it's trivial, utterly trivial, compared with the damage that this weak economy is in fact doing to the future and not just the present.
But if you're right, why wouldn't the bankers agree with you? Because they want to see growth. They want to see businesses with the confidence to borrow. Then they would presumably benefit, too, in the long run.
Well, part of the answer is, whoever said that being a banker necessarily means you understand macroeconomics? It's not the same thing. Some of them do. Actually, it was kind of interesting. This morning's Financial Times, the Financial Times being not the bankers, but being sort of reliably an organ that reflects what at least a part of financial opinion believes, has an editorial that looks like the paper's been taken over by a secret cabal of Krugmanites. It says exactly what I've been saying. It says that we need to. This is a time to be borrowing more. It's a time for the Fed to be printing more money, for the European Central Bank to be printing more money. So they're saying exactly what I'm saying.
They're a pretty liberal paper on their editorial page, actually, the Financial Times, generally, don't you think?
No. They've been up until now. They've been supporting the austerity policy of the British government, and I'd like to ask them how that. How their current editorial jives with what they've been saying up to now. So no, they've actually made a substantial swing in my direction. Larry Summers, by the way, has an op-ed. Now that he's a free man, no longer in the government, he's saying pretty much the same things I'm saying too. The other thing worth saying, I guess, is that bankers, in many ways, let's put it this way, if you're a bondholder. If you own a bunch of bonds, then you actually benefit from an environment in which the economy is flat on its back and interest rates are low, which means that the price of existing bonds is high. There's a lot of, the creditor class is doing pretty well in this environment. The trouble is the creditor class is a very small group of people, and the rest of us actually work for a living, and we're doing terribly.
Stuart in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Paul Krugman. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Brian. I'm actually in Newburgh, New York. Professor Krugman, I just want to thank you for just being the voice of sanity for the past 3.5 years. At my dinner table, it's always, why isn't Obama listening to Krugman? In fact, why doesn't he hire Krugman? So I just want to really thank you for just being the clear and simple, yet very understandable voice of clarity. What I'd like to ask you to address right now is the size of the stimulus that you think is required. And say if we have 4 million people unemployed, how many of those should the stimulus reemploy, and what would that cost, and how should it be focused specifically? And I just want you to say that because you've been so good at that in your columns, say, 3 years ago.
Okay. If I had complete carte blanche here, I would go and say we need a stimulus that's big enough to get to bring the unemployment rate down to something like 5%, and that would be a really big number. What I actually do in
what would it be? $2 trillion? $3 trillion?
Well, you want to think of actually there's an annual number because we don't know how long this will go on, and so there's a certain amount you need to be spending per year as long as we're depressed. So right now we are producing something like 6% less than we should, which means that we would be spending ideally something like 4% of GDP to boost the economy, because you don't have to do the whole amount, because there's a, to use the jargon, there's a multiplier effect. If more people are put to work, they spend more, and that puts additional people to work. So it's so in an ideal world, I'd be talking something like $500 or $600 billion a year. What I do argue in my book is that we can do a lot of it. We can get a long ways there by spending about $300 billion a year, which is, and that happens to be extremely easy to do, because that's just providing aid to state and local governments to reverse the cuts that they've actually been making. That's enough to rehire those school teachers, to get class sizes back to what they were before the crisis, to get the staffing of police departments back to what they were before the crisis, and to start filling the potholes again. So you can get right there, $300 billion a year, which would make a huge transformation in the situation. No need for any new exotic projects, no need for any new permits or anything. You can just do it right there. It would be basically a stroke of the pen. Of course, tremendous political obstacles, but that's politics. And or put it another way, public employment, which is basically school teachers, firefighters, and policemen. That's most public employees. Public employment normally grows along with the population. It did that under George Bush. It did that under Ronald Reagan. But it didn't under President Obama because of the trench warfare he's faced politically. Instead, we've laid off 600,000 public employees. If we were to return to that normal track right there, we'd have something like 1.2, 1.3 million people employed directly, and then through indirect effects, probably another 800,000, 2 million more people at work. So the point I try to make here is that this is actually really easy. In terms of the technical stuff, it's not as if we have to go and draw up plans for a national high-speed rail network, although I'd be all for that, or that we need to have huge Manhattan projects for green technology, though I'm in favor of that too. But we can get most of the way out of this depression just by rehiring those school teachers.
We'll continue in a minute with Paul Krugman on the new jobs numbers, the presidential campaign, his book, End This Depression Now. And I'll ask him why he uses the word depression instead of slow recovery, which is what a lot of people say we're actually in. Paul Krugman has a book signing, by the way, tonight at Barnes & Noble Union Square, 7 p.m. until 8 p.m. We'll also ask Dr. Krugman why he wrote recently that Chris Christie is an economic phony with respect to New Jersey economic policy. All that ahead. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with New York Times columnist and Nobel Prize winning economist Paul Krugman with us on the new jobs numbers, the presidential campaign. We'll get to Chris Christie and his book, End This Depression Now. And we'll get back to your calls in a second. Our lines are full. You can post your comments and questions to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And per your book title, I thought we're in a slow recovery. So why do you call it End This Depression Now?
Okay. So my take on it, there is no formal definition of a depression, but my take on it always has been that a recession is when the economy is going down, and a depression is when the economy is down for an extended period of time, right? So we have this thing we call the Great Depression, which is more than a decade, which actually includes two periods of recession, pretty terrifying recession, and two periods of recovery, actually not all that slow in the case of both. But the fact of the matter was that unemployment was extremely high. The economy was deeply depressed the whole way through. The recoveries were never enough to make up more than a fraction of the lost ground. So an extended period when the recoveries just don't ever seem to get you back anywhere close to where you should be is even if it's not technically in a recession, that's a depression. That's what we're in right now. It's not as bad as the Great Depression. I've been suggesting that as an Obama re-election slogan, not as bad as the Great Depression. Somehow I don't think
catchy.
You're going to go for that one. But that's That's the reason, because I think that is the right way to think about it. If recovery just doesn't seem like the right word for what is now 3 years of growth that has really made very little dent in high unemployment and a persistently depressed economy.
Bob in Mountainside, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Dr. Krugman, this Bob Murphy from the Austrian School economist, and they have been very prominent recently due to the fact that they called this boom and bust cycle that we're in right now. We've recently applied a lot of stimulus all over the world, and he's challenged you to debate.
Yeah.
And why have you ducked this debate? Now, considering
Hang on, Dr. Krugman, go ahead. And then, Bob, stay there because I'm going to come back to you. Dr. Krugman, go ahead.
This is not something to be settled by public circuses. Right, the question of who's quicker on the uptake, who delivers the best one-liner, is not how you settle economic issues. And I just don't think that the public interest is served by turning this into entertainment TV. That's not what we're going to do here. We're going to have this on the issues. I would say, by the way, that the Austrians have been spectacularly wrong through this crisis. They've been predicting high inflation just around the corner, year after year, for 4 years running. Keeps not happening. Why should I dignify that totally wrong doctrine, that doctrine that's gotten everything wrong, you know, by giving them a platform for some bread and circuses for the populace?
Bob, do you want to take on one piece of that yourself? Do you want to make one of the Austrian arguments?
Sure. Listen, I'm not a trained economist, but, you know, I just follow that school of thought. If Dr. Krugman is so... you know, sure of himself, and why did he turn to personal criticisms of persons?
But do you want to raise any substantive issue yourself, or just focus on why you want to debate?
Sure. Listen, we have not had the ultimate crack up, as Mises predicted, because the Fed has kept interest rates too low again. And that's why we're just in the situation that we're in. And it's just going to be worse when it eventually happens.
Okay. I just want to say something. This is an interesting thing, because I was actually, I find myself in a number of situations. But one of the amazing things here is people like me say, your doctrine has been completely wrong. Because you've just made wrong predictions, hasn't worked at all, and people start saying, that's a personal criticism. That's not. I'm not criticizing the person. I don't think I've ever said a word about any particular Austrian as an individual. Saying the doctrine doesn't work, and that's something that is best explained with careful arguments and charts.
Maybe it would be good for America if you and whoever it is from the Austrian school that Bob is promoting, went on CNN for 90 minutes three times and really had it all out at a, you know, great level of detail without the personal attacks, a lot of substance, disagree with each other, bring your charts. You know, one of the great problems we have in the United States is people are uninformed. People still think Iraq had something to do with 9/11. Why? Maybe that would be good.
Well, I'm not quite sure how you do the charts on TV. I will say, I mean, here we are broadcast on the radio, and that's fine because that's what people do to keep abreast of stuff. But if we can have a chance where the actual evidence can be brought out instead of, you know, who's the best performer? Because, you know, I'm not a trial lawyer. I'm not an actor. I'm actually just an economist trying to figure out how this thing works and what we need to do to get out of it.
I want to get to your recent column on Chris Christie. You called him a fiscal phony up there with Paul Ryan. You say the Ryan plan, the House Budget Committee chairman plan, actually would increase the deficit over time, even though he's trying to help Romney run against Obama by calling his a deficit reduction plan. But you said Chris Christie is in that camp, too, for his New Jersey fiscal policies. How so in New Jersey?
Okay. So the big test of phoniness on this is what happens to someone who claims to be a tough guy, a fiscal hawk, when he's asked to sacrifice something he wants instead of sacrificing something other people want. So the reason I say Ryan is a phony, aside from the fact that his numbers don't add up, is that he talks tough about the deficit, but it turns out he actually wants to cut taxes on the wealthy and on corporations, and all of the sacrifice he's calling for come from the poor. So he's, you know, this is I don't see any willingness to actually make tough decisions. It's all good for people, for him and people like him. So Chris Christie has just come in. He's been, you know, basically making a big deal about how tough he is and willing to make hard choices, and doing lots of canceling of stuff that other people wanted, including that desperately needed tunnel. Now his numbers are coming in bad. The budget, the revenue is coming in below expectations. Looks like there's a big hole in the budget. So the first thing he did after all of this, you know, I'm tough, I'm realistic, is to attack the messenger and start yelling about insults at this veteran nonpartisan budget analyst works for the state who came in with the bad news. And the second thing he did was to say, well, am I going to give up on this tax cut that I really want because it's going to be part of my political selling point in the next campaign? And the answer is no. Instead, he turns to a bunch of budget gimmicks to try and fill the hole. So confronted with the reality that some tough choices are needed, he first tries to deny the reality, and then he says, well, you know, somebody's going to have to make a sacrifice, but not me and not any of the things I actually want. So he's a phony. He's all the toughness is an act. He's very, very tough about demanding that other people give up stuff they want, but he won't give up anything he wants.
Well, what does he want? I mean, wouldn't the Democrats be spending more if Corzine was reelected with a Democratic legislature, meaning even more of a structural deficit?
Well, except they wouldn't be setting out to cut taxes. I mean, I don't know. They would probably, in fact, if you look at Democratic governors around, you look at Cuomo in New York, you look at Jerry Brown in California, they're working pretty hard. They're making a lot of painful cuts in an attempt to balance their budgets. So
what should they cut in New Jersey?
Well, I think, you know, New Jersey has a whole bunch of New Jersey actually probably, first of all, it needs higher taxes. We need a higher tax on gasoline. A lot of what's been going on is Christie refusing to accept the fact that we're going to need some more fuel taxes to pay for the transportation budget. We do have clearly a proliferation of independent townships. There's too many governments in New Jersey. There are some excessive pension benefits, no question. That's an exaggerated issue, but it's not a fake issue. So there's a whole bunch of things where cuts need to be made. But the fact of the matter is that given the kind of menu of choices that are reasonable, a reasonable government would make, which would be a mixture of cutting some spending, raising some more money. Christie, it turns out, is only willing to do the ones that are somebody else's priorities, not willing to give an inch on his own priorities.
You talk about raising taxes in New Jersey, gasoline taxes, for example. Let me play another Romney clip that very succinctly, in 13 seconds, states what Republicans and conservatives think the effect of tax hikes are on jobs.
This president seems to think the best way to create jobs is to raise taxes, because everywhere you turn, he's trying to raise taxes one way or the other. Taxes kill jobs. Taxes don't make jobs come back to America.
We hear it over and over again, job killing taxes.
Yeah.
You don't think they do?
Which is why the after 1993, when Bill Clinton increased taxes, we had such a terrible economy under Bill Clinton, and why after 2001, when George W. Bush cut taxes, we had such a great economy, right? And by the way, Obama has not raised taxes. Obama has cut taxes. Almost everybody is paying either the same or lower taxes than they would have. Obama would like to raise taxes on top incomes, eventually back up to the levels they were during the Clinton years, which was, as you may recall, a time of a pretty good economy. You know, history, this is a doctrine that has, I mean, how many times does it have to be fall flat in its face? You know, how many pratfalls do you need? The best generation of economic growth this country has ever had is the generation after World War II. And that was a time when taxes, particularly on high incomes, were much, much higher than they are now. And during Eisenhower, and that socialist Dwight Eisenhower, the top top tax rate on high incomes was 91%. Now, I don't actually advocate that. I think that's probably higher than is it really makes sense. But this is a doctrine that's held completely in the teeth of evidence. There's not a hint in any of the story of the United States or actually any place else that the kinds of changes in tax rates in the range that we're talking about are going to make a bit of difference to job creation.
We're almost out of time with Paul Krugman, New York Times columnist, Nobel Prize-winning economist, author now of End This Depression Now. He'll be doing a book signing tonight at Barnes & Noble at Union Square at 7 o'clock. But you talked about the New Jersey economy and how New Jersey is not doing as well as New York and Connecticut in the recovery, and you hang some of that on Christie's austerity. But you're right today.
No, I didn't, actually. I actually made a point of not doing that. I don't think what state governors do has very much impact on their economies. It's just there's just not a lot that you can do. And I actually was quite specific about not actually blaming Christie for it.
All right, stand corrected. But what do you think about the New York economy? Stats from last month that we were just talking about on the show the other day showed the fastest pace of job creation in the city in 60 years in the first quarter. Is New York somehow immune to what's happening nationally?
Unlikely. I mean, there's some stuff, you know, the financial industry is coming back, which I'm not sure is a good thing from a national point of view. I mean, there are pockets of job creation in the country. You know, there are any place that's got an energy sector has been bouncing back. I actually haven't looked hard at what's going on in New York. But look, let me be bipartisan here. I don't think Christie has much to do with what's going on in New Jersey. I don't think Cuomo has much to do with what's going on in New York. We really do have a national economy which overwhelmingly determines what happens at the state level.
And you know, there's a school of thought that even the federal government has very limited power to do much about this recovery, either with a Keynesian or a Milton Friedman approach or whatever, because since this was a recession brought on by a financial crisis, that's always a steeper recovery curve than a recession brought on by the ordinary business cycle. How much do you agree with that?
Not at all. What is true is that the recovery from financial crises tends to be slower than the recovery from an ordinary business cycle. And that's because the usual tool we use, which is monetary policy, is much harder to use. Basically, there's a lot of things you can treat with over-the-counter medication. Most recessions can be treated with over-the-counter medication. This kind of thing needs something stronger. But there's also overwhelming evidence that fiscal policy does work under these circumstances. There's overwhelming evidence that if you can find the political will and the intellectual clarity to actually act and create jobs, it can work very well indeed. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the Great Depression was ended by fiscal policy. It wasn't a deliberate policy exactly, but it wasn't quite exactly the war. It was when war started in Europe and the United States began ramping up its military spending to get ready that we came out of the Depression, and we did it very fast. In the middle of 1939, there were lots of people saying, oh, there's no way we can have a quick recovery, we can create jobs. And over the next 2 years, we created the equivalent of creating 26 million jobs today. So, no, this is all wrong. People are mistaking the fact that governments usually mishandle the aftermath of financial crises for the economic impossibility of a quick recovery, which isn't there at all.
Paul Krugman, he will be signing his book, End This Depression Now, at 7 o'clock tonight at Union Square, Barnes & Noble. Thank you very much for spending this time with us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Anthony Swafford. You know him from the book and movie Jarhead. As part of our End of War series, Swafford will tell us what he thought he would find in war, the greatest challenge to whether he was a great man, and what he found instead. Stay with us.